Now, last week we were in chapter 24, and we were talking about the obtaining of a bride for Abraham. And Abraham had wives and he had concubines, as did, for example, King Solomon. It was not unusual in the ancient culture of the Middle East for a well-to-do man to have to practice polygamy. But so what's the difference between a wife and a concubine? There are differences. And the differences are these. A wife is actually she's a legal wife. There's legal documents, and just like when we get married, there's legal documents that are signed and so forth. If you no longer want your wife, let's say, you have to get a divorce. A concubine doesn't actually have any legal standing. They're sometimes called a wife, but they have no legal standing, there's no ceremony. And if a man chooses to, he can separate from a concubine with no divorce, because you were never really legally married. But the main thing is, for our purposes, is that if you're a wife, your children are heirs. If you're a concubine, they are not. So, for example, if you have John, and John has Mary, who is his wife, and Rebecca, who is his concubine, and they both have children, when John passes away, the inheritance will go to Mary's children because she's his legal wife. Okay? Excuse me?
Solomon was not David's wife.
Well, it's interesting to try to determine what he was. I don't know. I mean, she became a widow.
Yes.
So he could have married her.
True. Yeah.
The possibility existed. And as a matter of fact, even had she not, when she wasn't a widow, he committed adultery. But Solomon does say in Ecclesiastes that he had many wives and many concubines. So apparently in his day, a man of means could have more than one legal wife and also more than one concubine.
So it's a possibility that David actually married Bathsheba later.
Yeah, there is. It just didn't...
Doesn't say.
It wasn't within the purpose of Moses' writing. You know, it was irrelevant to what he was driving at. But yes, I would say it's highly possible that she became his wife later. Okay, so now we're going to move on. You'll note chapter 25, something happened to my computer and I had to redo it, but it's not numbered. So go to the last page, chapter 24, which is 101, and then when you turn the page, you'll come to chapter 25. And in the Bible, we'll just start at Genesis 25. Okay? Now, just to kind of get us started, at this point, the life of Abraham came to a close, and God's blessing was transferred to Isaac, his only son. Now, notice son has those... what are those little things? Quotation marks around it, because he was his son, and from a certain legal standpoint, because he took possession of the Esau's birthright, he still was not born first. But remember, we said there can be a distinction between the one who is born first and the one who is the firstborn. That's a title. So when it says he was his only son, what it means is he was the firstborn, and he would get the inheritance and the blessing. This passage includes four sections. The births of the other sons of Abraham. A lot of people don't know. They think that God made Abraham and Sarah fertile just so for Isaac, but the fertility that God gave to Abraham, to Isaac and Rebekah, wait, to Abraham and Rachel, continued on after that. They had more children. As a matter of fact, we'll see, after Abraham's wife died, he took more. I live over there in Tustin. I can't even speak their language, let alone get a lot of wives. Very good neighbors, though. I'm living in a small hotel. I mean, what is it called? An apartment house. Well, my neighbors are from Mexico. But they're nice people. I talk to them all the time. We can't understand one another. But with the words we can understand, we always have these little conversations. Okay, anyway. So this passage includes four sections: the births of the other sons of Abraham, the safeguarding of Isaac's inheritance. And you can see when you read A, from what Isaac's inheritance has to be protected. There's other sons around now. And Abraham was quite wealthy. Compared to our time, he probably was what one would call a billionaire. Tremendously wealthy. Isaac inherits the promise, but there's these other sons lurking around, and I'm sure they would get ideas. So Abraham took steps to safeguard Isaac's inheritance. The death and burial of Abraham, and the blessing of Isaac in verse 11. Okay, that's pretty much the way the way it's divided up. Okay, so let's read verses 1 to 4 first. Now Abraham took another wife whose name was Keturah. She bore to him Zimran and Jokshan and Medan and Midian and Ishbak and Sheba. Jokshan became the father of Sheba and Dedan. And the sons of Dedan were Asherim and Letushim and Lumen. The sons of Midian were Ephah and Epher, and Hanok, and Abidah, and Eldah. All these were the sons of Keturah. So Abraham standing before God saying, I can't make children anymore. If God wants you to make children, you'll make children. Now Abraham gave all that he had to Isaac. But here's what he did. Oh no, that's... I don't want to go that far yet. I want to go to the notes first. I just want to cover the first four. Okay, so Keturah was Abraham's concubine. We don't know when Abraham married Keturah. Now notice that the phrase that's used there, married. They didn't have a legal marriage ceremony. Still, word. This is 28. Ugh. Anybody else need 28? Could you pass one back to her? Thank you. Okay, so now we have to be careful here because notice what B says. Keturah was really a concubine and not a wife, as was Sarah. And we get that from 1 Chronicles 1:32. That would mean that there was a maximum span of 37 years for the births of Keturah's six sons. Because Abram was 138 years when Sarah died, and he died at the age of 175. Wait, did I read the whole of A before I started? Okay. Yeah, when it says the verb took and the adjective another, that implies that Sarah had passed away. Now, God's going to make a mighty nation out of this family. And sometimes people question, how can a family become a nation? That would have to take centuries. But I'll show you something interesting. It's the same kind of argument that people often give. Starting just from Adam and Eve, it would take forever to populate the earth. And starting from Noah and his wife and his three daughters and their husbands, it would just take forever to replenish the earth. But here's the population growth. There are two kinds of growth. One kind of growth is arithmetic growth. That's one type of growth. Things, something. Another type of growth is exponential. Now, here's the difference. With arithmetic growth, let's start both of these with two people for the sake of argument. Now, let's go. How many are we going to do? One, two, three, four. Okay. Let's do four generations. With arithmetic growth, what happens is 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. It's growing arithmetically by twos, right? With exponential growth, what happens is 2, 4, 6, 8, 10. Now here we went 1, 2, 3, 4 generations. 1, 2. I hope I can do this so I have enough room. 3, and 4. I'm not going to bother to draw the twos. These are all the, so watch how many, now this is four generations of exponential growth, right? Here, if we total this up, we get 18, 28, 30. 30 people after four generations, if the growth is arithmetic. Here we get 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14, 16, 18, 20, 22, 24, 26, 28, 30, 32, 34, 36, 38, 40, 42. So you can see that's 12 more after just four generations. That's not that big of a difference, but if we would take this to like 10 generations, there's no way we could fit this on the board. That's the way it starts to grow so fast.
And you're using only 2 as the number.
I'm just consistently using number 2. It could be a larger number. But the thing about geometric growth is it doesn't just grow on a straight line. If you measure on, you know, a graph, arithmetic growth, it's a straight line that looks like this. If you measure geometric growth, it's a line that starts off slow and goes like this, because you start getting to, I mean, here we had four, right? Here we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16 times 2 is 32. If we just take this, in fact, there's a challenge that people sometimes make. I'll bet you can't get a chessboard, put one penny on the first square, two pennies on the second square, four on the third square, and fill up the, that notice that's the geometric growth, 2, 4, 8, okay? You wouldn't, there aren't enough pennies in the world to fill the board. It starts growing by leaps and bounds when you have geometric growth. That's the kind of growth that takes place with disease. That's why you have to, if you get sick, you don't want to wait around and just figure, well, I'll get better. Because a lot of diseases that we may get, they may multiply geometrically. And so you're just feeling a little sluggish one day, and the next day you have a little cough, and all of a sudden, 5 days later, you can't get out of bed. That's geometric growth.
Are you equating that with arithmetic growth? Geometric growth is the same as arithmetic?
No, geometric and arithmetic are totally different.
Totally different.
Because every increase here is by two. Mm-hmm. That's called an arithmetic progression. The amount of increase is doubling here. So it went from 2 to 4 to 8. See, it's a doubling process. There's another way this can be done, and populations can grow this way. You can go from 2 to 4, and this is another kind of geometric growth, and then you can go from 4 to 16. Now, what am I doing there? Anybody see what I'm doing there? I'm not adding 2 each time to my... I'm squaring it each time, you know what I mean? 2 twos are 4, 4 fours are 16. This thing grows out of sight. So if anybody ever says to you, there's no way the world's going to be repopulated in just one millennium. It's going to be populated fast. Once population growth begins, it starts out slow, but it doesn't take long. I mean, you may have seen, sometimes you have a family that has the great-grandparents. And don't forget, we were only giving each person 2 children. They had a lot of children back then, so that would make it more. But have you ever seen a photograph of a family when all the great-grandparents and the grandparents and the parents and the children all get it looks like almost a city. So that's the way population growth is. If anybody ever says to you, there's no way just from 2 people, yes, all you need is 2 to start with. As a matter of fact, one of the reasons that the atom bomb is so powerful is because you have an atom that is shot into this substance, this highly refined uranium, and that atom hits one, and the uranium molecule is very unstable. It's too big, so it's unstable. And when the atom hits that molecule, it releases electrons. No, when the electron hits the uranium molecule, releases its electrons and heat. Now, one molecule is not going to produce very much heat, but you get a geometric progression. And so within less than a second, you have so much heat being produced that can destroy a city. If you would ever look at the amount of highly enriched uranium that you need to make a devastating atom bomb, it's about the size of a softball. You don't need much. You don't need very much. Anyway, back to the scriptures. Tribes in, let's see what it is. Yeah, we did that. See, tribes in Sheba and Dedan in Arabia, as well as the Midianites, came from Abraham. This was in fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham that he would become great, since so many nations looked to him as their ancestor. And as I've mentioned before, the three greatest religions, and when I say great, most significant religions in the world, Christianity, Islam, and Judaism, those are the preeminent religions of the world. All three of those religions claim that Abraham is their forefather. And there's others, too. There's others as well. Okay, the safeguarding of Isaac's inheritance. Abraham loved all these boys. He gave them gifts. And I'm sure those gifts were not just, you know, here's a dollar. He was a very, very wealthy man. But they and their descendants may have posed a threat to Isaac. Now, what was it? Was it that Abraham just loved Isaac more? Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. But why did these other sons posing a threat to Isaac, why was that so crucial? It was so crucial because Isaac was in the line of promise. And if those other sons were somehow able to steal Isaac's inheritance or get rid of him or do whatever evil, jealous men would do, there would go the Abrahamic covenant. And as we read through this, we'll see that a lot of the decisions that Abraham has made were made based on his, how important the Abrahamic covenant was and his part in it. But they and their descendants may have posed a threat to Isaac. So Abram sent them away as he had done with Ishmael. He sent them to the land of the east, thus preserving Isaac's right as Abraham's heir. So he was protecting the line of the seed here. Okay, now Abraham passes away. The burial of Abraham, 7 to 11. So let's go back to the scriptures. These are all the years of Abraham's life that he lived, 175 years. Abraham breathed his last. You know, it's interesting. I saw somebody breathe their last once. A woman had terminal cancer, and I was there. I was a friend, and family was there. We went out into the hall for a couple minutes, and she was at any time ready to go. And I went back inside, and I'm just standing there looking at her and praying and stuff like that. And her breathing was very shallow, and all of a sudden she went, and that was it. She breathed her last. It's eerie. Okay. While Isaac and Ishmael together buried their father, oh, we didn't read 7. I wanted to make that. Abram breathed his last and died in a ripe, could be good old age, an old man and satisfied with life. And he was gathered to his people. That's fulfillment of the portion of the Abrahamic covenant when God said, I will bless you. He blessed him even throughout life and death, he blessed him. He led a long, prosperous life, and then it seems to describe his death as like no one murdered him or he didn't get some hideous disease. He passed away. It was his time to go. Then his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave at Machpelah in the field of Ephron, the son of Zohar, the Hittite, facing Mamre. Remember when he bought that? The field, Abraham actually bought it. The field which Abraham purchased from the sons of Heth. There Abraham was buried with Sarah, his wife. So now they're reunited in death. It came about after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac lived by Beer Lahai Roy. Now, it has a little section here from 12 to 18 that's almost an aside. It's the descendants of Ishmael. Since Ishmael was a son of Abraham, Moses gives us some information about the direction that his posterity took. Now these are the records of the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maid, there she's called Sarah's maid, well, Hagar, I got confused for a moment. This is not Keturah anymore. This is Hagar, right? Bore Abraham. And these are the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names in order of their birth. Nebaioth, the firstborn of Ishmael. See, if Ishmael had been able to somehow get the birthright back, the inheritance back and the promise to himself, then who would have gotten the inheritance? Not Jacob, but the firstborn of Ishmael, a man by the name of Nebaioth. So that's why Abraham had to take these steps to preserve the promises made to Abraham and Sarah. The firstborn of Ishmael, and Cater, and Abdiel, and Mibsam, and Mishma, and Duma, and Maseh, Hadad, and Tema, Jetur, Naphish, and Kedema. You know, when Abraham got his juices back, he didn't waste any time. He had a lot of children. That's in Hebrew. That's how you say it. Okay. These are the sons of Ishmael and their names by their villages. Notice that each one became a city. And by their camps, 12 princes according to their tribes. So each one became a tribe of its own. These are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. And he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. They settled from Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt, as one goes towards Assyria. He settled in defiance of his brothers. Now, let me ask you a question. I can find my pen. This is not a pen. What do I do with my pen? I hate when I do that. Here it is. Here it is. Let me ask you a question. See how sharp you are today. Suppose I brought two individuals to you, two men, and I said to you, one of these two men is in the lineage of Isaac. The other man is in the lineage of Ishmael. That's all I have to say. Tell me which is which. Could you do it? Yeah, but no, forget Isaac and Ishmael. Just two men. I got two men standing here. And all I'm going to tell you about them is one of these two men, yes?
They've done some DNA studies now, and they're finding that the Palestinians and the Lebanese and the Arabs, they actually share 80% of the same DNA that the Jewish people.
Yeah, but we can't use DNA because we're back like...
But still.
Yeah, but I'm disallowing modern technology. And it's a much easier way to do it anyway. How could you distinguish who was the descendant of Ishmael and who was the descendant of Isaac? Very simple. Well, what'd you say? Well, we know that. But how would you tell? Look, watch. I'm going to make sure you get this. Bingo. The descendant of Isaac would be circumcised according to the Abrahamic covenant. The descendants of Ishmael would not. They were not under the Abrahamic covenant.
Let me ask you a question. How many people would actually say, prove to me you're circumcised?
I prove it all the time. Somebody challenges my Judaism.
Yeah, if you were trying to pass as Gentile, and whether it's school kids or somebody else.
Yeah, and today there's a debate over it today whether or not medically circumcision is a wise thing to do. But if God says to do something, you know, start saying, is it wise? You just do it. Okay, let's move on. Okay. While Isaac and Ishmael together buried their father in a cave where Sarah was buried, Ishmael's presence might have posed a threat to Isaac's rights now that their father was dead. But God's blessing rested on Isaac. He was in the line of the seed, and therefore it was his descendants who would bless the land, possess the land forever. Also, since he was in the line of the seed, Isaac and his descendants, God would protect him. He would protect that line. For example, that whole fiasco with Abimelech. Remember when Abraham lied to Abimelech? Abimelech was a king. He didn't have to hold the trial if he didn't want to. Off with his head. But he didn't do that because God, although Abraham did wrong, the Abrahamic covenant rests solely on the faithfulness of God. So God saw to it that Abimelech, number one, did not have relations with Sarah. And number two, he protected Abraham. God himself made it clear to Abimelech, don't harm this man. Okay. Isaac was then living at Beer Lahai. This was a place where God was known to respond. God had heard Hagar there and delivered her. Remember that? And Isaac meditated there while waiting for his future wife. Thus, Isaac lived at a special place, a place where God had answered prayer. So we're getting a little picture of his character now. Now, we're going to see this, maybe not today, but when you have a place that you go to and you worship there and you make a habit out of worshiping there, or God answers prayer when you pray there, what people would do is they wouldn't build an altar. It's not called an altar, but they would stack rocks on top of one another. And that indicated this is a holy place for prayer and it would be a place people went to pray. It wasn't actually an altar. It was a sanctuary for prayer. Okay? Questions before we take our first break? Yes?
How do you feel about this being the first mention of Isaac since the Lord's sacrifice? So the question is whether he was purposely living apart or if the whole thing
had been. Wait, say that once more. I'm sorry, I didn't get the whole thing. Well, we can say the question, was there an estrangement, doesn't have a specific answer, but we can imply by the fact Isaac went and buried his father, Abraham, in the cave where he was. Isaac still loved his father, and there was no estrangement. Otherwise, he wouldn't have taken steps to do that.
Well, so did Ishmael.
Well, we're talking about Ishmael right now. We're talking about Isaac. The scriptures don't say anything at all about Isaac having anger or bitterness about what happened. And I'm sure that Abraham on the back explained to Isaac just what happened.
Well, that's the thing. According to scripture, he didn't go back with Abraham.
Well, then what before they left? At some point in time, I'm sure he made him understand. I'm sure in the more happened here, I'm sure. Say that there was an estrangement simply because they separated from one another. One of the reasons to this one too many sheep and goats and lives in a different place. That, but the Bible doesn't say that Okay, that's the first break. Okay. Now, we should be on, well, the pages aren't numbered. At the top of the page where it says the burial of Abraham. And we just covered 25, 7 through 11. We just have to read number 7. When Abraham by faith sent away all his sons, he provided for transfer, it should be two, to transfer his blessing to Isaac, who waited on the Lord. Abraham would be gone, but God's program would now continue to grow and expand from generation to generation. Each of God's servants must do all that he can to ensure the ongoing work of God, but the work is bigger than any individual. Two vivid examples of that are, first, Esther. Remember when Mordecai first came to her and said to her, you know, this is what I want you to do, and so forth. And she didn't want to do it. And Mordecai said to her, if you don't, someone else will. But don't think that you'll escape. Said a little more. No, he said it pretty gruffly. Because God's program is greater than Esther. Not that God doesn't love Esther, he does. Ananias and Sapphira lied to the Holy Spirit right at the inception of the church. And God said, I can't have this going on in my church. I can't have lying and deceit going on in my church. And he removed them. When Abraham by faith sent away all his sons, he provided for the transfer of his blessings to Isaac. That's how that should read. For the transfer of his blessings to Isaac, who waited on the Lord. Abraham would be gone, but God's program would continue. No leader of the covenant is indispensable, for God's program to bless the world will continue to grow and expand from generation to generation. Each of God's servants must do all he can to ensure the ongoing work of God, but the work is bigger than any individual. And that's not to demean us or to put us down. We're precious in the sight of God. But God's work of redemption has priority over me becoming a rich man. Unless me becoming a rich man in some way enhances God's program of redemption. But God, the way I would say it is, God will not allow his program of redemption to in any way be marred just so I can benefit. That's not what it's there for. Okay, the succession from Ishmael, verses 12 to 18. Now, these are the records of the generations of Ishmael, Abraham's son, whom Hagar the Egyptian, Sarah's maid, bore to Abraham. And these are the names of the sons of Ishmael by their names, in the order of their birth. Nebaioth, the firstborn of Ishmael, and Cater, and Abdiel, and Mibsam, and Mishma, and Duma, and Massa, and Hadad, and Tema, and Jeter, and Naphish, and Kedmah. These are the sons of Ishmael, and these are their names by their villages and by their camps, 12 princes according to their tribes. And in Genesis 17, that was prophesied. These are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years. And he breathed his last and died and was gathered to his people. They settled from Havilah to Shur, which is east of Egypt as one goes toward Assyria. He settled in defiance of all his relatives. And let's go to the notes. Ishmael was also a son of Abraham, so God told what would become of him and his line before returning to the chosen line, the line of Isaac. So because Ishmael was a son of Abraham, he lets the reader know what happened to this other son. So there's no question in your mind about him. Ishmael had 12 sons, as God had predicted, and died at the age of 137 years. His sons lived in the Arabian Peninsula from Havilah in north century Arabia to Shur between Beersheba and Egypt. The Ishmaelites lived in hostility to all their brothers, as God had predicted to Hagar. That's in chapter 6, verse 16, verse 12. Okay, now we move over to Isaac. After briefly mentioning, and here's what it should say, after briefly mentioning Ishmael's line, see it? The narrative returned to the chosen line through Isaac. So Ishmael's line is just given brief mention because it's not part of God's redemptive program. But he did want to recognize it because he was a son of Abraham. The first section, 25:10 through 28:32, records Isaac's prosperity and Jacob's struggle for the right to it, events within the land of promise. Chapters 29 to 32 relate to Jacob's sojourn out of the land of promise. That word blessing shouldn't be there. Chapters 33 to 35 record his return to the land and possible corruption of the land. Okay, now we... A little louder, I can't hear. How could they be Hebrew women? There's no possibility of that happening. The only way you can be a Hebrew is by being a descendant of Abraham.
Yeah. Okay. So then, were they just wives that were in...
That was the culture back then. It wasn't unusual.
No, I'm not saying that it was unusual, but then what happened? He had his wives, and then he just sent them off, and there's no more Hebrews like that.
No, he sent them off, and he gave them... He gave them plenty to get along. Believe... I wouldn't be surprised if each son that he sent off as a millionaire.
So where is their women?
Their what?
You hear about Ishmael, and they can follow that line, but what happened to the line of those sons?
The scripture gives us just a brief lineage and then leaves, because that lineage does not in any relate to the promises and the blessings in the covenant. It's like, why isn't this guy's lineage in here, or this guy's, or this guy's? It's only Isaac's lineage and his life story that's pertinent to the line of the seed and the promises.
Yeah.
And so Moses is being selective here. It's not really a history book. It contains the history necessary for us to understand how God's plan of redemption is carried out. That would not be wise, because if they did that, they probably... Remember what I told you, how wherever you lived, the tribes in your area, they'd always have a pact. If one is attacked, all defend.
Yeah.
I don't think any tribe would put up with something like that happening to one of their neighboring tribes, because they could say, what if it happens to me? So that would be foolishness on the part of any one of those sons. Plus, they'd be fighting against God, and I think they knew that. Okay, the transfer of the promised blessing to Jacob instead of Esau. Now, this is going to take us all the way to chapter 28, but we're going to start with it now. The oracle at the birth of the twins, 25, 19 to 34. Now, these are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abram's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel, the Aramean, and Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban, the Aramean, to be his wife. So he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there, and there Isaac's servants dug a well. Okay. The account of the births of Jacob and Esau is a fitting introduction to the following chapters, for the struggle for supremacy manifested itself even before their births. Now, first we have something going on with Rebekah, Esau, and Jacob. Let me ask you a question. Who was Isaac's favorite? Esau. Who was Rebekah's favorite? Jacob. So here we have a little inter-family competition going on here. Okay, let's read verses 19 to 29. Where are they? Go to the right page here. He called the name of that 19 at the start with verse 8. Wait, 8. Make sure I know where I am. Oh, we're on 25. No wonder I can't find anything. Okay, I got to go step back a little bit because I was reading from the wrong place. Okay. Let me read. I want to go back to verse 19 and read 19 through 34. Now, these are the records of the generations of Isaac, Abraham's son. Abraham became the father of Isaac, and Isaac was 40 years old when he took Rebekah, the daughter of Bethuel the Aramean, of Paddan Aram, the sister of Laban the Aramean, to be his wife. Isaac prayed to the Lord on behalf of his wife because she was barren, and the Lord answered him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. A little different from the way Abraham and Sarah handled it, and less problematic. But the children struggled together within her, and she said, "If this is so, why am I this way?" So she went to inquire of the Lord. The Lord said to her, "Two nations are in your womb, and two peoples will be separated from your body, and one people will be stronger than the other, and the older shall serve the younger." Let's see where. When her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. Now the first came forth red all over like a hairy garment, and they named him Esau. Afterwards, his brother came forth with his hand, holding on to Esau's heel, so his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 60 years old when she gave birth to them. When the boys grew up, Esau became a skillful hunter, a man of the field, but Jacob was a peaceful man living in tents. Now Isaac loved Esau because he had a taste for game, but Rebekah loved Jacob. When Jacob had cooked stew, Esau came in from the field and he was famished. And Esau said to Jacob, "Please let me have a swallow of that red stuff there." Anybody you know where you get the name Esau from? Esau comes from the word red. Actually, it's more to do with, not as much to do with what he ate as his appearance. And Esau said to Jacob, "Let me have a swallow of that red stuff there, for I am famished." Therefore, his name is called Edom. Edom, which means red, or this red. But Jacob said, "First sell me your birthright." Esau said, "Behold, I am about to die, so of what use is that the birthright to me?" Well, obviously, he wasn't going to die. He was being a little dramatic, but he was also being very foolish because he didn't value the birthright very much. He sold it for a pot of stew. And Jacob said, "First swear to me." So he swore to him and sold his birthright to Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread, lentil stew, and he ate and drank and rose and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright. That's like me if I were a son of Donald Trump and I was the firstborn and I was to inherit the whole thing because Donald Trump didn't want his empire all split up among his children, right? No, I'm not the firstborn. I am the firstborn. I am the firstborn. And I go out hunting and when I come back, I'm so hungry. And one of my brothers, who's not the firstborn, is making a nice pot of stew. And I said to him, "I'm hungry. I just went hunting. I haven't eaten. Give me some of that stuff to eat." And my brother said to me, "First sell me your birthright," which is billions, right? And I said, "What good will that birthright do me if I die? Give me some of that stuff to eat." It seems like you'd have to be crazy. But the spirit battles against the flesh. Here's a nice, good pot of stew. Who knows what's going to happen to that birthright anyway, somewhere down the road. Very foolish. Okay. Back to the notes. Rebecca, Esau, and Jacob. Rebecca, Isaac's wife, was also his cousin. Isaac's marriage to Rebecca thus brought him to Abraham's native country and family and to the Arameans in northwest Mesopotamia, later known as Syria. God supernaturally provided a son for Isaac. Like Sarah, Rebecca was barren, even though God had promised that nations would come from Abraham. Isaac prayed and God responded. So Isaac handled the situation, I think, a little better than his father. Although his father handled it well too, but all Isaac did was pray. Because that's all you can really do. And it's just, if your wife is barren, there's nothing you can do except pray, unless you want to go to one of these maniac doctors and have them do experimental death. Okay. God supernaturally provided a son for Isaac. Like Sarah, Rebecca was barren, even though God had promised that nations would come from Abraham. Isaac prayed and God responded. This shows that births were sometimes supernatural provisions. I think every birth is a supernatural provision, to tell you the truth. In Judaism, there are three things. When a woman conceives, and this, whatever you want to call it for the moment, starts to grow inside of her, what makes it to be alive? What makes it to be a life separate from the woman carrying it? And just might interest you, in Judaism, there are three theories. One theory is that part of humans being made in the image of God is that we have been given the capability of creating life. And that's held by some scholars. Another theory that's almost humorous, but it's an ancient theory, is that there's a room somewhere up there in heaven, a very, very large room, and it's full of souls. And every time a man and a woman have sexual intercourse and the woman conceives, a soul is sent down to be in that body. And it keeps happening, and the end of days will come when the room is emptied out. A third theory, and this is the one I tend to go with based on my study of scripture, is that only God can make life. So the man and woman come together, and at conception, God breathes life into the, what is at that point in time, an embryo. I think that the life comes from God and not the parents. Okay. But there was conflict in Sarah's womb. When she went to inquire about this from the Lord, it should be, not from Lot. From the Lord, she received a prediction from him. Two nations were struggling in her womb, and the older would triumph. That's not right. It should be the younger would triumph. Because the younger did triumph. Yeah, that's wrong. Where it says, that's because that's bad theology, where it says the older will triumph, cross out the word older and put younger. Indeed, the Israelites, Jacob's descendants, and the Edomites, Esau's descendants, fought continually. God's election of Isaac the younger over Esau the older was against the natural order. As we said, usually the one who is born first is the firstborn, but this one against the natural order. The parents observed the strange situation, and in view of God's oracle, they commemorated the event by giving them appropriate names. The first of the twins was red and hairy, like a little animal, so they named him Esau, red. The mention of red anticipated the future nature of Esau. He was a warrior. Fascinating word plays were used to describe the first twin. The name Esau has a loose connection with the word seer, the early name for Edomto, the south west of the Dead Sea, where Esau lived. That should be one sentence. It's not typed out right. Let me show you how it should go. The early name for Edomto, southwest of the Dead Sea, where, and make it all one sentence. Get rid of the period after C and make a lowercase w. That set wasn't typed up right. The Hebrew word for red, Admoni, is related to the word Edom, where Esau later lived. The second twin was born grasping Esau's heel. In view of the oracle the parents had received, it seemed appropriate to give the child a name that would preserve the memory of this event. The name Jacob means may he protect, and you see after the word protect you should have end quotes, was selected because of its connection in sound and sense to the name heel. The verb akab means to watch from behind. But as with Esau, Jacob's name would take on a different sense in later life as his deceptive nature became evident. You all know the story of Jacob wrestling with the angel, right? And you know that the angel was the Messiah, pre-incarnate. And it's fascinating to read and see what Jacob's character was like before and after that wrestling match. His whole character changed because he had an encounter with God. Okay. The name also meant one who grabs the heel. So the twins' births had great significance later in their lives. God's fulfillment of his promise to Abraham was carried out by his election of Jacob, later the nation of Israel, at the same time on the human side, prayer was necessary, verse 21. God's promise is carried out through prayer in his supernatural work. God later gave Israel, his elect nation, the promise, but it would not come without Israel's struggle. That's something we should remember. Prayer is not passive. If you have a prayer, something you either need or your family member or anything, you should pray about it. But then to the extent that you can do something about it, you do it. You don't say, I prayed about it. That one's done. God wants us to partner with him in accomplishing his work. A central theme of the remainder of the book, the struggle between brothers, is introduced in the brief account of the wrestling of the twins in the womb. Already in chapter 4, the struggle between Cain and Abel has foreshadowed a whole series of conflicts within the book. Now look at this. The sons of Noah, Abraham and Lot, Isaac and Ishmael, Jacob and Laban, and Joseph and his brothers. Conflict all the way down through the ages, even in the chosen line. Such an emphasis on enmity and struggle appears to originate from the first words of judgment in the book, God's statement, I will put enmity between your offspring and hers. So that seems to have come true. Moses waits to the end of the book to thematically express the lessons. By the way, everybody familiar with the word enmity? Not sometimes somebody. It means strife or conflict. Okay. Now, one of the things we have to remember, as believers, we should not take up our own defense in spiritual matters. We should defend the gospel. But the Bible says the battle is the Lord's. And he says, vengeance is mine, I will repay. Now, he may use nature if he wants, like the famine in Egypt that brought the Jewish people, actually at that time a family, up into Egypt. If he chooses, he may use a nation like Babylon, who accomplishes ways. So he could use another nation. He certainly used Israel in cleansing that whole area of godless nations. And sometimes he will directly battle a nation, as he did with Sodom. The point is not so much that the struggles were necessary for God's will to be accomplished, but rather that God's will was accomplished in spite of conflict. See, when you read this story, if you read this story and take God out of it, everything would have been a complete mess. It wouldn't have gone anywhere. The whole world would be different today if you just take God out of this one family. Another important motif is present in this account. The older will serve the younger. As far back as chapter 4, the narrative has portrayed God choosing the younger and weaker through whom he would accomplish his purpose and bring about his blessing. There's what scholars call, and it appears for the most part in the Gospels, the great reversal. Now, when you go to the Gospels, to whom did Jesus go? The downtrodden, the sick, the poor, and what did he say to them? Blessed are you, for yours is the kingdom of heaven. The meek shall inherit the earth. That's called the great reversal. Those who are rich and wealthy and don't put their trust in Messiah, in the long run, will not reign victoriously. But those who are poor and humble, but faithful to God, in the long run, will be blessed. Now, that's not to say it's a sin to be rich, by any means. It depends on what kind of character you have, what you do with your riches, because you're if God makes you rich, you're a steward of those riches. But it does seem that this world is based on upside down priorities, and that God, in his time, is going to make them right side up. Yes?
Why wouldn't the great reversal be that God accepted the Gentiles also?
That's true that happens, but that's not what they call the great reversal. Just doesn't apply to that. But what you're saying is true. If you wanted to put a title to the Gentiles being accepted, I wouldn't say the Gentiles experienced a great reversal, because then you're using the same phrase to describe two different things. I would simply say that the Gentiles were grafted in to the promises of the covenant. Yeah. Okay. The intention of all these reversals was the recurring theme of God's sovereign plan of grace. The blessing was not a natural right, as the right of the firstborn son would be. Rather, God's blessing is extended to those who have no other claim to it. They all received what they did not deserve. And always remember, these aren't meant to be definitions, but it's meaningful. Grace is getting what you don't deserve, a blessing that you don't deserve. Mercy is not getting what you do deserve. And God is a gracious, merciful God. So that we can take on an individual level. Thoughts, questions? Okay.